European leaders have put out the call to social media sites and tech companies like Google to crack down on extremism on the web. Social media sites for groups with extreme religious or political groups to plan and communicate sharing potentially dangerous and toxic events and ideas. While terrorism exists as a global issue closer to home, we see extreme left and right-wing political supporters band together online to attack opposing sides in the name of activism over issues like the current gay marriage plebiscite. Joining us now is Professor Greg Barton, Chair in Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University, to talk about the near and far implications of online extremism. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Ian. Good to be with you.
Look, are issues like this under the jurisdiction of companies or governments?
The reality is it's only companies that have the technological capacity and position to make some of the differences we want. But governments risk making things worse by shifting the blame to companies and suggesting that companies have some sort of magic powers, which they don't, and that governments that also have a role to play in this. It's a very complicated relationship. And at the end of the day, whilst it's important to try and, as far as possible, make sure offensive content doesn't go online and constantly work at limiting the power online, it's not just about online content. It's about the actual human relationships and social networks that are behind it, and that we can get distracted by the technology and forget the larger problems.
Well, you're a fairly liberal-minded person, I think, Greg. How would one... We don't want to sort of clamp down on people's ability to debate and spread ideas, but how do you actually define extremism?
Look, I think the important thing to think through when it comes to setting limits on extremism is whether somebody's just expressing strong ideas or whether they're undermining the basic sort of human rights, the personhood, the equal human value of somebody else. So, in other words, if somebody's effectively inciting hatred or treating somebody else as less than human, showing bigotry, racism, whatever, then that's the problem. It's not that they can believe the moon's made of cheese if they wish. Of course, human beings have diverse views when it comes to religion and every other ideological and political issue, and that's not the issue. People should be free to express those views. It's a question of whether they could be respectful to others. And we need to be prepared to say that if there's incitement to hatred, if there's suggesting that other people are not of equal value, then that's crossed a line. It's easy to sort of articulate it. It's harder to actually apply it on a ongoing basis, but that's the challenge ahead of us.
And that's the nub of it, really. I mean, we do have laws in Australia about discrimination and as you said, diminishing the humanity of another human being, on a number of grounds, which some people actually want to water down in politics. But we do have those laws. So why doesn't the government act on those when they see them actually being undermined or crossed?
Well, it's part of the challenge of law in general. It's one thing to have something on the law books. It's another thing to be able to respond in a timely fashion and to be able to prove the case. I mean, often it's a question of proving intent. People often see things which are offensive, proving that somebody's taken a position that's clearly crossed a legal line and being able to prosecute that in a timely fashion is the challenge. Law's never going to be perfect in this space, so it does mean that sometimes there's going to have to be cases that are symbolic importance because you can't address every single one. Technology makes it hard because if people hide behind anonymity, or at least it's not possible to really prove who says what, and the sheer volume of material that goes online makes it virtually impossible to deal with everything. So we need a combination of measures. Tech companies are very good now at using automated routines, algorithms to find offensive material and pull it down. That's part of the solution. But we also need a mature adult discussion about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And I think it's reasonable we look to our elected officials and public figures to set the tone on this. And, lately there's been some real disappointment in this space.
Now, while you say that, governments are sort of pushing it off when they blame companies, is it fair enough to say that companies like Facebook or Google aren't doing enough when, they seem sort of quite ready and able to take down images of nudity, for instance? as opposed to sort of, you know, rather extreme rants by people?
I think it's fair to be critical of these social media companies. They're in a very fast evolving space, and by definition, they're going to constantly be trying to catch up. We've just had acknowledgement from Facebook that it wasn't fully aware, wasn't paying enough attention to Russian interference, allegedly, in the American election and, you know, buying of ad space on Facebook. That's one aspect. The other point, though, you mentioned about, I mean, there has been excellent work on taking down, for example, child exploitation material on social media. The companies have done a very good job there, and they should be applauded for that. And that begs the question, well, if they can do that, why can't they pull down sort of terrorist propaganda? Part of the problem is that one category of material is much easier for automated routines, algorithms to identify. The combination of factors is relatively simple. It's much harder to prove not just for a human, but for the machine learning processes that have to deal with millions of items in a short space of time. It's much harder to identify what constitutes terrorist propaganda. That's an area where a human being does the job much better than the machine, but we need the machines to do it because the volume of material is just such we don't have enough people to be able to do it. So that's an evolving area. Twitter and YouTube have got very much better at this just in the last few months. Perhaps it's because they're paying more attention. Perhaps it's because the technology has improved, but I think we need to be encouraging them to do the right thing rather than sort of slamming them and holding them out as somehow not doing enough. It's a fine balance between keeping the pressure on them and working cooperatively with them.
And that sort of brings us back to the common culture we live in, because, you know, when you say, you know, we don't have enough people to look at all this at once, and really, do we want to live in a society where we do have enough people to be watching everything at once, you know? Debating in public about what is acceptable and what's not and what we want as a society.
But that's a very good point. We don't want the East Germany of the Stasi, for example. No one wants to go there. We don't want an intrusive Big Brother presence. What we do want is to work with technology and systems and laws in such a way that those who would incite hatred, those who would try and groom and recruit for terrorist purposes, those who'll be pushing hateful right-wing or left-wing or other extremist messages or Islamist messages, we just find it very hard in that space. I mean, we're never going to completely block things off to them, and technology's never going to be the total answer, and indeed propaganda is not the total answer. We've got to look at the underlying enabling conditions and drivers, but we've got to make it much harder for them to do things that they've been doing relatively easily. And this is another area where we're in catch-up mode with technology, particularly social media and the way in which it's changing our society.
Well, we're all aware, I think most people are probably aware of various sites that pop up during, you know, matters of public debate, such as the marriage equality opinion poll that's going on at the moment. And, you know, occasionally you see racist or other homophobic or sexist sites or, you know, posts on social media. How public and effective, and how easy is it for most people to access, say, terrorism sites? I mean, I personally have never been to one. I've never seen anything that I would have remotely thought related to it. But we do hear news reports, you know, about these sites. So how sort of popular are they? How easy are they to find?
It depends what you mean by terrorist sites. There's a multitude of material out there. A lot of this material exists for the purposes of hooking somebody in, of getting them to pipe up and make a response in a forum so somebody can identify them and then cynically befriend them and groom them. Then, of course, once that relationship starts, the propaganda material can help shape their mind, shape their thinking, but it's a hook to try and build a relationship. And that means material that gets posted on social media, including YouTube or Facebook videos, which may get pulled down after a short amount of time. Nevertheless, it's popping up all over the place in such quantity that once people start looking for it, it's not hard to find. I mean, one of the devilishly difficult things to combat with social media is that social media systems are set up to learn our preferences and to give us more of what we like. One of the dangers is we end up living in an information bubble where the only information feeds we get are about things that the machines, the learning systems, sense that we're interested in, so it confirms our prejudices or at least our opinions. It's a kind of an echo chamber, and that applies to terrorism. So if somebody starts looking for terrorist material. I mean, some of the more extreme stuff may be hidden in the dark web, but a lot of the sort of standard videos and commentary pieces are out there freely available. And once they start showing interest, the social media systems start throwing more at them. So it's a never-ending job to try and pull that material down. It's also a challenge to try and put an alternative narrative out there so that if somebody's looking for something, they're forced to think more critically about what they're consuming. And to be fair, the social media companies are beginning to do this. So YouTube and Google are beginning to work with governments and people fighting terrorism to redirect people searching for offensive material to sites that cause them to think critically. But, you know, there's no simple fixes in this space. And if anyone says you can't find terrorist material online, it's probably because, very understandably, they haven't been looking for it and therefore it's not been thrown in their direction.
Well, that is an interesting point that you make, that someone could be engaging with a site that at first hand doesn't appear to be, you know, engaged with terrorism, might have some kind of radicalism attached to it, and then they're friended by somebody whom they don't know, and then they're in a conversation and then taking part in activities that they perhaps wouldn't have necessarily thought of themselves. From your experience, are you aware of how that's affected anyone in Australia who's been engaged in acts that have brought them in contact with the law in regard to terrorism?
Well, it's a good point, because all of the cases that we're aware of publicly of people being recruited, I think it's fair to say that the details that we do know suggest that people have been recruited through somebody befriending them, often striking up a conversation in an online forum. And the really dangerous material we're concerned about is often then forwarded to them through encrypted messaging, through Telegram or WhatsApp or other kinds of encrypted messaging, so that they're not having to go out and find it themselves on the web. It's sort of been delivered to them. And the combination of somebody apparently showing interest in them and being their new best friend, grooming them cynically, and then feeding them a stream of dangerous material through encrypted messaging means that often we only find out about this until it's very late in the day. There was, for example, a 17-year-old boy in the north of Melbourne from a good middle-class family, a good school, dropped out of school, was locked in his bedroom. School friend saw very angry posts on social media, called the national hotline. Police came in and found three almost fully assembled bombs, IEDs. And it turns out that somebody had been chatting with him from Syria, another boy from Melbourne, and others, and that he'd fallen victim to this sort of searching for friends online and had fallen into a very bad circle. And his family and other friends knew nothing about this until almost too late. But that's the pattern when we look behind the scenes. It's people deliberately, generally seeking to groom or to befriend or to persuade. Sometimes friends do this as a group themselves, but often it's an older person looking for a younger person in a very cynical fashion.
Well, there's certainly a few things to be wary of, and thank you so much for joining us this morning, Professor, and putting some semblance of reality on that topic.
Good to chat. Thanks very much.
That was Professor Greg Barton there, and he was talking, he's the chair of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University, and he was talking there about the use of online platforms to facilitate extremist ideologies.